So good afternoon, everyone. Congratulations. You made it to 4 o'clock. And I partly say that because I recognize that for many people who come to a retreat, even people who've practiced for a long time, the first day of the retreat is not easy. And in fact, if we describe the first day in our publicity of the retreat, no one would come. And that's unfortunate because it's actually quite beneficial to go through the challenges. But you might not believe that at the moment. I've heard tell a story of some person who can meditate, like you all, and was somehow involved with a bunch of, I think maybe Marines, who were like gone through boot camp, and really tough, strong, competitive people. And so in this competitive mode, the meditator said, you know, in a kind way, let's see. Can you do what I can do? Let's sit still, upright, for 45 minutes. And only one person remained seated at the end of 45 minutes, and that was the meditator, because it was too much for these tough Marines. So I don't know if that's an apocryphal story or real or something, but I tell you the story because some of you might not realize what a phenomenal thing you've done so far today. This is an amazing thing to do, to hang in there through this. And some of you have probably, how many of you had headaches today? It's a good number. How many people had more pain today than you expected? How many of you are more tired today than you expected? How many had a worse time than you expected the first day? It's all part of the process.
Now I feel guilty.
Now you feel guilty because you didn't. Yeah. Well, then finally you caught up. And what I'm trying to say is that it's all permitted. It's all part of the parcel. And there's a wonderful way in which I believe that there's no mistakes on retreat. And we kind of get what we need to work with and be with, whether it's difficult or easy or wonderfully liberating or not. And there's something very mature about learning to be present for what you're given, what arises, what's here. Rather than having some idea, it's supposed to be this way. It has to be this way. This is my preference. But to learn a kind of freedom that comes when we can be equanimous, wise, present, non-reactive, without disappointment, with whatever has arisen, whatever is here. And so for the people who had a difficult time today, or challenging time for their bodies, or all kinds of things, that's kind of part of the training. That's kind of meeting that, being with that, finding our way with that, negotiating ourselves with it, understanding ourselves better as we go through that, and trying to find some semblance of freedom or equanimity or wisdom about how to be with this. For the people who had a comfortable and nice and pleasant day today, that could be very meaningful and very important. And it also can be a setup, because then this expectation, this is how it's supposed to be. And I've had retreats where I've gone through, you know, sometimes I've been a very slow learner. So I have, you know, I've had a difficult first day, and I concluded that I shouldn't be there. The second day was kind of really nice and calm, and I'm like, I'm a great meditator. I'm like the, you know, wow, I just know how to do this. And when are they going to give me the badge? And then the third day happens. And it's a whole other challenge has come up. And it's like, I don't even know how to meditate. And then, it goes on and on and on. Finally, at some point, I got the message. And the message was not to be so wedded to the particular experience of the moment, but rather to learn how to be present for it in a way that was maybe equanimous, wise, not in conflict with it, not struggling with what's happening, and learning how not to struggle, how not to be in conflict, is just as relevant when things are going well and when things so-called are not going well and when they're challenging. So I like to kind of believe that on the retreats that there's no mistakes, that there's something very, I've been a teacher for a very long time now, been talking to lots of people, and it's from 25 years plus of retreat teaching that I've come to this little piece of pop psychology, that there are no mistakes on retreat. It's just part of the richness of what we have to meet and be with, and hopefully we set up the retreat and the teachers offer the kind of support that helps you to find your way with whatever is going on. And So I just want to appreciate all of you for this first day, and especially those of you who might have found it difficult, that I very much appreciate what you've done and how you've made it this far, and I hope that you're also balancing your efforts to be here with a certain degree of self-care, that you take a break, maybe some of you took a nap today, and somehow find the right balance for you so you can be here in an effective way. So the theme for this retreat is most simply maybe is wisdom and equanimity and wisdom. With the Buddha's definition of a wise person being someone who benefits self, benefits others, and benefits both self and others. And when we're talking about wisdom and equanimity, it can get pretty heady, the discussion. And in thinking about this today, I was wondering about a substitute for a way of saying this. And maybe another way of saying the same thing is the following. Trust awareness and love everyone. And if you want a little bit longer, trust awareness, love everyone, including yourself. And this idea of trust awareness, I kind of equate with equanimity, because there's something very profound about the human capacity to know, to be aware, to be mindful. It's a phenomenal operation that, you know, we take it so much for granted, the fact that we know anything at all, aware of anything at all. I think most of you have successfully navigated the stairs going down here, from here to the first floor. And probably you didn't think about what an amazing feat that is. I mean, the amount of perceptual calculations the mind has to do about perceptions and distance and feet and all these muscles and balance. And I mean, it's like, it's not a simple thing to do. But we take it for granted, most of us. A couple of years ago, I had foot surgery, and I did not take it for granted. We take it so much for granted, the idea that we're aware, because we navigate through the world, but we're not focusing on being aware. We're focusing on what we're aware of, and many times we're focusing on what we're thinking about. But to some degree, to be thinking about anything, there has to be some modicum of attention that goes into those thoughts. As we get more mindful, as we settle down and develop a capacity for mindfulness, there is a shift that begins happening where we begin seeing and being aware, knowing there's still what we're thinking about, there's still what we're aware of, but rather than thinking that's the whole picture, what we get kind of focused on, we become increasingly aware of awareness itself, increasingly aware of the capacity to be mindful, to know what's happening. And as that capacity to know gets stronger and stronger, then our relationship to what we know begins to shift. For one thing, what we know no longer becomes the only game, no longer is the only game in town. But there are many people who they've never been taught anything else, and what they think and what they kind of focusing on, the focus of attention, focus of concern, is the whole game. And so it's a matter of manipulating it, changing it, fixing it, doing something with it. But there's a whole other half of our lives which is not what we're concerned with, what we're noticing, what we are thinking, but the awareness that knows that. And slowly we're beginning to shift the attention from being locked into what we're concerned with to include a bigger picture of what's happening here. And that bigger picture is, we could call awareness or mindfulness or attention. And it's a phenomenal thing we have. You know, any moment that you're aware, it's the product of the whole expansion of the universe and cooling of the universe and evolution that's happened for the last 5 billion years. It all comes to a pinnacle at this moment for each of you in a variety of things within you, but the fact that you could be aware, where did that awareness come from? It evolved, it developed out of this cosmic explosion and particles and then the coming together and cooling and slow, 5 billion years. And then somehow this amazing universe developed the capacity to know itself, which is one way of understanding the human awareness. The universe knows itself. And we're just the excuse for it, or we're the conduit, or we're the ones who move it around. So the universe can, you know, be aware of more things than just what's most local or something. Anyway, it's an amazing thing, this capacity to be aware. And so this is the kind of the medium through which mindfulness is being developed, this capacity to know and be aware. And one of the things we start discovering is that our awareness often comes along with baggage, often comes along with attitudes and beliefs and desires and aversions. And it's seldom that we allow awareness to operate in a relaxed, open way without being involved with what we're aware of. We judge it, we want it, we prefer it differently, we reject it, we pull away. And it's okay to do some of these things. It's not like it's wrong to do it. But we can get locked into those so we don't see the nature of awareness itself. We don't see that awareness by itself, there's a simple way of knowing what's happening any moment that does not have preferences, that does not, is not for or against anything, that is not troubled by anything, doesn't need anything, doesn't trying to change anything, it just knows. And that simple capacity can be quite foreign to people who their lives are constantly lived in, you know, preferences and wanting and needs and trying to be safe and, you know, to all these things that are part of human life for sure. But to trust awareness is to trust that there's a way of being aware that's very simple, that doesn't have, in and of itself, not operating from preferences, not operating from desires and aversions, that allows what's known in awareness, allows what's known to arise and be there, and we don't disturb it. It's like Thich Nhat Ajahn Chah, the Thai teacher, said that when, I think he was referring to meditators, and in the monastery, I guess it was noisy, and so maybe some of the monks complained about all the noise that was bothering their meditation. And he said, no, it's not the noises that are bothering you, you're bothering the noises. It's the activation that you, we have of aversion to it and all kinds of judgments about it and things, you know, that resistance to it, that's where the heart of the what we have to address to become free. And so not a few meditators, and I'm one of them, have struggled with the sound of someone in the hall who made a lot of noise. When I was doing a three-month retreat, there was a person who sat next to me in the hall, and he always came into the hall late. I think about 5 or 10 minutes late after the sitting had started and everything was quiet and peaceful. And the way he entered the hall, there was a meditation hall, there was a long hallway coming to it, the wooden hallway, and he had what I called at that time the lumberjack approach for entering a meditation hall. So you'd hear this pounding of the floor as he would go, here he comes. And you know, then he would sit down next to me. And I don't know what he would have been up to, but every time he sat down, it was like he'd been running. And he would be spending the next couple of minutes breathing really heavy, kind of like catching his breath. So then I was sitting there doing mindfulness of breathing. And then at some point, he had a Velcro jacket, the infamous infamous Velcro jackets, and he would rip it open. And so this was a bit of a challenge from my meditation. And so, you know, day after day, so I got to look at my reactions, how I bothered the sounds. You know, all this stuff was going on with me, and I certainly was self-righteous, and it was easy to blame him, it was all his problem. If only he didn't do what he was doing, I would be sailing in my meditation. I'd be like on the brink of enlightenment. But, but you know, that Velcro jacket. And slowly, I learned to just be aware of the sounds and allow, and at some point, it became almost like a mindfulness bell for me. I wasn't bothered anymore. And I would hear the pounding footsteps, and just, you know, I was kind of a little bit grateful. It was something to include in awareness. Awareness was so special, so nice to be aware. Awareness has no weight. It's very open. It's clear. It's spacious. And like something has to go through that space. And you know, his foot's going through a space. Footsteps were going through the space was just as good as my breathing going through it. And so it just came, and I wasn't ruffled. He would sit down and do heavy breathing, and I wasn't ruffled. I wasn't ignoring the fact that he was heavy breathing. It was just one more sound, just a sound. And then came the Velcro jacket, and I came to appreciate that sound. Oh, look at that, there it is. And some days I would notice that the Velcro jacket, when it start ripping open, that I would say, I kind of say to myself, thank you, because only then did I realize I was lost in thought. No, it brought me back. And if I was not lost in thought, at some point it was just like, you know, like, I don't know, like, you know, like a breeze through space where there's no resistance to it. It just kind of, there was no resistance to the sound. It would just come right through my mind. So this idea of trusting awareness, like it's enough just to be aware and not have agendas, not try to make something happen, not have to think about it, not have to analyze. It's an amazing thing to trust our capacity to be aware. Now, sometimes it can feel like that's not enough. But one of the things that about trusting awareness this way, where you kind of just let things be, let them just kind of appear and arise in awareness, know it, and let it do what it needs to do. The breathing arises, in-breath arises, just breath. It's not like, you know, is this, you know, is am I getting concentrated yet? It's just a breath arising. The breath goes, and you know, I'm not measuring it, and it's just really the kind of breath I'm supposed to have. Am I supposed to be deeper or longer? Or just sensations of breathing out occur, and it just happens in awareness. In and of itself, it can be a relief compared to the usual reactivity that people have, many of us can have. But it's more profound than this. And that is that if we can be that simple, but very clear, it's not like being complacent. It's really being fully as we can with the experience that's happening, really showing up for it, but then just allowing it to be. It contributes to, I don't know the right way of talking about it, but it contributes to a natural process towards health, to healing, towards freedom. There seems to be, in the human psychophysical being, a natural movement towards health, a natural movement towards healing, and a natural movement towards liberation and freedom. And we don't have to be so much in charge of making it happen. But we do have to create the conditions for this natural process to unfold. And a big part of the natural process is getting out of the way, but staying present. Getting out of the way in the sense of learning how not to be reactive, not to be for or against, being willing to experience whatever it's happening arising for us, and not disturb it, not get reactive to it. And that makes room for something to begin to unfold and to move. And the analogy I like a lot, and you often talk about, is if you cut your finger on the kitchen knife or something, the healing of that cut is a physiologically quite a complicated event. And I suspect that none of us here in this room have the intelligence to direct the show with all the chemicals and antibodies and proteins and all the things that got to happen to make it. It's just, I think it's pretty complex. And so, you know, we couldn't figure it out probably. But our body knows how to do it. Our job is to keep the cut clean, to optimize the body's opportunities to do the healing that they can do. Same thing with our hearts. Our hearts can be broken in so many different ways. It's kind of heartbreaking how many ways hearts get broken in this world. The heart also has a self-healing mechanism. If we can get out of the way with awareness, be present, and just hold everything in this kind awareness, open awareness, hold our broken heart. And if we're bargaining, if we're negotiating, if we're trying to find a solution, if we're doing a lot of things, some of them might be useful, but there's the thing that's not very often understood in our society is the tremendous value of sitting quietly, not doing anything particular, but allowing what needs to happen to occur in the space of awareness. But we have to be aware. You can't say, okay, I'm going to just let the natural process unfold, so I'm going to check out. You know, I'm going to sit here and, you know, I know. I mean, this is the, you know, I have all this time on retreat. This would be a very efficient time to plan what I'm going to do in 2018. Let's start in January. You know, and by the end of the sitting, you've gotten to February, and, well, good, we have more sittings left, so I can plan everything out, because I'm just going to trust this. It has to, that doesn't work that way. But we have to trust awareness, or trust in awareness, by staying aware. We have to be with what's happening with a clear way. It's kind of like we offer the space of awareness, or the container of awareness, or the presence of awareness, but we have to be aware of something. And but it, while when we're aware, it's possible to trust. This is how it is. This is how it is. So this trusting awareness that is non-reactive, is not acting on being for or against things, not acting on having preferences. It's okay to have preferences. It's okay to have desires for what you're gonna, what's supposed to happen. But in the act of awareness, we don't let those kind of operate. We let awareness operate alone, just to be aware. And that's one of the things we're doing when we keep coming back to the breathing, is we're not just trying to develop concentration or stability by breathing mindfully, but we're also trying to discover what it's like to be aware of the breathing in this uncomplicated, non-reactive way, and to do so more continuously, so we have this continuity of this non-reactive attention. And there's something about the continuity of breathing, it comes and goes, it's almost always there, that for many people works really well as a training ground for discovering how to have this non-reactive awareness, this uncomplicated awareness, where we just trust being aware of the breathing. And that's a training in this kind of trusting awareness. And if you're trying to accomplish something by being with your breathing, that's okay. It's possible to accomplish something sometimes. But that's a different kind of practice that comes from this deep trusting awareness. And so much of our inner life, so much of wisdom, so much understanding, so much process, so much love and compassion can well up from inside, from this kind of trusting awareness and letting things come. What also can come in trusting awareness, or the analogy the Buddha gives for, or borrowing from the Buddha, is that of a beautiful, clear, pure mountain lake in which no rivers flow into it to refresh it, no rain falls on the lake to refresh it, but there's an underground spring, underwater spring, that wells up from the bottom of the lake to renew and refresh the lake with fresh water. So, same thing when we sit in awareness and make space, it allows, makes room for something to begin bubbling up, something begin to surface. When the Buddha uses analogy, it was a lot of our goodness, sense of well-being that can well up. But what we know is that sometimes what needs to well up is some of the unresolved issues in our lives, some of the things we've been ignoring and not being with. So sometimes we sit there and what wells up is a lake full of tears. Will this ever stop? And just, you know, just coming. That's what needs to happen. Sometimes what comes is anger. All kinds of things can come. And so this trusting awareness is, okay, now I have to be with this. Let's be with this. And it works best if there's this non-reactive awareness of it, space and awareness for it. Appreciating with awareness, it doesn't bother the anger, it doesn't bother the sadness, just there. It's the direction in which the practice is going. It's not necessarily easy to come to that, and there might be a lot of things that have to happen to work out and understand and before we can get to it. But it's nice to, I think it's nice to kind of see that this level of equanimity that we're going towards is a very profound thing to develop. Because equanimity, some people think of it as being kind of indifference or aloofness. It's really the opposite. It's a profound allowance of our life to kind of move through us and be in a very deep way. Is it okay to wait? So for me, this idea of trusting awareness and equanimity go closely together. Now, the Buddha talked about a wise person is someone who's concerned with the welfare of oneself, the welfare of others, and the welfare of self and others. And so this is related to this idea of developing this kind of sense of freedom that can exist within open awareness, this freedom that can come with non-reactive awareness, this trusting awareness thing. Because it's a state where of goodness, a state of health, a state of freedom that is independent, where there's very little suffering, or maybe no suffering at all. And for people to know this, to know this experience, is to know some of the most profound sense of goodness and well-being that a person can have. To know the real, in a profound way, the experience of not having a heart which is troubled or bothered or is suffering, or really have a sense of what it's like to not be in conflict with anything. Even if people are in conflict with you, to be without conflict is to know something about some of the most healthy, beneficial, useful, happy ways of being. And to know it for oneself, really know it, then we can wish it for other people. We know that this is possible for others. If all I know is that I'm really happy when I get the latest gadget, latest iPhone, if that's make me happiest, then if we want other people to be happy, we just wish them iPhones. You know, that's not going to go very far in terms of profound happiness in this world and peace. But to really know something deep inside, this deep wellspring of liberation and freedom and well-being for ourselves, then we can have a real sense of what's possible for other people. And when we wish other people well and want to support other people, we have a reference point for what that can really mean. And I think sometimes then we can offer people something much more profound than if we don't know it. We can wish them much more concern for their welfare in a whole different way. In the suttas, in the Buddhist discourses, he has a discussion about four kinds of people. The first kind of person has no concern for the welfare of anybody, including themselves. The second kind of person is only concerned about the welfare of others. The third kind of person is only concerned about the welfare of themselves. And the fourth kind of person is concerned with the welfare of both self and others, both. What's interesting about this list is that it's presented in a hierarchy of which ones are better. So clearly the thing that's worse for the Buddha is having no concern for the welfare of anybody whatsoever. That's maybe understandable. But what's a little bit strange is this: third from the bottom is only being concerned for the welfare of others. And there's not a few people who get the message that really, in order to be a good person, you have to put others first and not be concerned with yourself. But for the Buddha, it's actually better to be concerned with your own welfare than the welfare of others. But even better is to do both. So, but why is it that being concerned for one's own welfare is better than only being concerned for the welfare of others? One reason is that you have to begin understanding what is really beneficial for yourself. It doesn't mean getting a new gadget. That's not what real benefit is. What real benefit is learning to work through some of the ways that we contract, we hold ourselves closed, we tighten up, some of the ways in which we wrap ourselves up in knots, some of the ways in which we are deeply attached to things, some of the ways in which we deeply resist our world or in conflict with what's going on, to really kind of understand how this works and free ourselves from it, then that concern for self cannot be selfish. Because selfishness is some of those things: contraction, tightness, preoccupation. If we're being mindful, if we're being aware, we will learn sooner or later the cost of such things like being selfish. It's going to feel just really off. It's going to feel like it doesn't work. It's too painful. It turns out that being selfish harms the one who's selfish. So the concern of benefiting oneself is impossible to do that while a person is self-preoccupied in an egotistical or selfish way. But if we really want benefit oneself, then we kind of drop the hate. We drop the resistance. We drop the ways we're closed. We drop the ways that we're afraid. And we're some of the kind of mechanisms within us that contribute to a difficult society, difficult relationships, the way that we might harm each other, begins to lessen. And that's a great gift to others. That's beneficial for others. And as I said last night, the built into Buddhist approach to life from the earliest time into down through the centuries is this idea that there's a mutual relationship between self and others. And it's possible to be a mutual benefit relationship, and it's possible to be a mutual harming relationship. But that as we benefit ourselves, we benefit others. As we benefit others, we benefit ourselves. And there's some funny ways in which this plays out in Buddhism. One of them is the practice of generosity. Generosity, on the surface, might seem like a genuine act to try to be supportive and helpful and generous to someone else. We can't be obligated to be generous. We can't be generous in order to get an award for ourselves. There has to be kind of a purity in just wanting to give and wanting to support someone. But the Buddha said that the person who's generous is the person who benefits the most. Now, if you are generous because you want to be the one who benefits the most, then it's not really generosity. But to find a way to be generous without being selfish, without doing it for yourself, the Buddha said, that's how you actually benefit more than the person who is the receiver. Isn't that kind of, you know, this mutuality, you know? I find that fascinating. And I certainly have, I don't know if I benefit more than others that I've been generous to, but I've slowly learned over these years that I've practiced to really appreciate and value and cherish what it feels like inside to be genuinely generous. The same thing with being compassionate. I was so surprised the first time I discovered this that it was a simple act of compassion. It was kind of unselfconscious. I was hiking in a kind of nature hike, a guided nature hike someplace, and there was a woman on the hike who we had to kind of scale little cliffs, little, you know, 6-foot cliffs or something, you know, and over these boulders, and it was a little bit physical and difficult, and she didn't have this ability to do it on her own. So I started just hanging back with her and kind of giving her hand, lifting her up and all that. And I started feeling so good. And I didn't know, no idea why, but I kind of started lingering and helping because it felt so good. And I kind of lingered, and I was like almost like doing it for my sake, because I felt this warmth and this tingling and this kind of fullness and all this good feeling. And I didn't think about it too much. It was kind of almost unconscious that I was choosing to do this. But then many years later, I read about compassion, and that pure acts of compassion, meaning compassion is not entangled with fear or greed or selfishness, that it releases all kinds of wonderful chemicals in the body, like oxytocin. And it's kind of like you feel good. And then the Dalai Lama came along and says, if you want to be happy, be compassionate. If you want to benefit yourself, care for others. If you want to care for others, benefit yourself. So this kind of mutuality, you can't get away from it. They work kind of together. And that the Buddha, that's what the Buddha said when he made this simile of the two acrobats. Apparently there were two acrobats. I don't know, maybe it was a real story. Someone came and told him about this. These two acrobats, there was the apprentice and there was the master acrobat. And it involved, they climbed on, the acrobat's assistant would climb on top of the acrobat and do handstands and headstands, and they would, like, you know, do all these amazing things, one on top of the other. And so as the apprentice was getting up to do the acrobatic feats in the air above the acrobat master, the master said, you watch over me, and I'll watch over you, and together we'll be safe. And the assistant said, no, I'll watch over myself, you watch over yourself, and that way we'll be safe. And then they went back to the Buddha, and someone went to the Buddha and said, what do you think of this conversation? And he kind of says he agreed with the assistant, but then he reworded it and basically said, the one who looks after themselves will look after the other. The one that looks after the other will look after themselves. There's a mutuality. And so here we are, searching for, on the quest of wisdom, the quest of understanding our life in a deep way. Wisdom that leads to the end of suffering. Wisdom that leads to greater compassion in this world. Wisdom that leads us to live in a world where we can get along and have profound respect for each other and love for each other. What is that wisdom? I think it involves this wonderful, it's supported by this wonderful sense of mutuality. It's not all about the other, not all about ourselves, but I feel that we're profoundly in this together. I think it's almost not understandable how deeply we're all involved in this together. We're distinct people, and we're profoundly interconnected at the same time. And our own welfare is tied to the welfare of others, and others' welfare is tied to our own. And I think that that's one of the things we come to realize more and more when we can sit with this profoundly spacious, open kind of equanimity of a non-reactive mind. Or if we trust awareness, sit here and trust awareness, because we don't have to be thinking about this, we don't have to believe what I'm saying, we don't have to calculate how this works, but if we can really settle back, be here, and be here in a way that awareness is open and trusting, where the experience of here, ourselves internally, the world around us is here in this world of flowing in this field of awareness. There's no way that we will not be affected by others. There's no way that we won't have an effect on others. We will know something, we'll be connected, and we'll have a strong sense that how someone else is, their suffering or their well-being, is kind of relates to ours, and ours relates to them. And I think it's a profound thing to feel this mutuality. And I think of Buddhism as a practice of mutual benefit, It's a mutual benefit society. We're not doing this just for ourselves. And in fact, the idea of liberation in Buddhism, I kind of like the idea that say it a little bit provocatively, for those of you who are interested in liberation, you'll never get liberated. That simply won't happen. What'll happen is you'll liberate everything else. Everything will become liberated from you. And even you will be liberated from you. You allow everything, whatever is here, whatever is really here, it'll become free of your agendas, your clinging, your resistance, your aversion, your confusion, your delusion. You're freeing what's here. And to me, this idea that it's not about me, it's not about my freedom, because it kind of doesn't make sense. But rather, we're doing this wonderful generous act of kind of getting out of the way so that everything that is can be free. And one way we know that it's free is when we trust awareness, when we allow it to kind of be in the awareness, just be here, be known. And if we do that, you'll be surprised by how much wisdom you have. There's a huge capacity for wisdom that we all have that's just waiting to come forth, to operate, if we start trusting awareness. And it's not just, and that wisdom is closely connected to love, because the Buddha, as the Buddha said, a wise person is concerned for the welfare of self, of others, and both self and others. That to me is an expression of love or of compassion. And that's been part of my surprise in walking this path, is the degree to which that I don't know how enlightened I've become. That doesn't quite compute. But I've become compassionate. I've become compassionate in the process. That kind of computes. Here. So, trust awareness and love everyone. What would that look like for you? And how is it that just sitting here, walking here, back and forth, sitting here with your breathing, could it be that the simple acts that what we're doing is, that's what it's about. It's coming in, growing and growing into this, moving into this possibility, getting out of the way, knowing how we get in the way, and discovering how to get out of the way. Trust awareness and love everyone. So, thank you.